This is a University of Otago podcast.
My name's Peter Joyce. For those who don't know me, I'm Dean at University of Otago Christchurch. And it's wonderful to see you all here tonight. And it's wonderful for our staff and students to be back in this building after 2 years nearly of earthquake repairs. And for those interested in such things, the building is now 120% of the new building code with completely new stairwells, with the old concrete taken out and now movable steel on wood stairwells, which has been part of what the builders have been doing in here over this time. So it's great this year that we're able to offer a series of 7 public lectures, again, after 2 years without being able to do these lectures. And this year, because when new professors are appointed within the university, they're required to do an inaugural professorial lecture. All of this year's lectures are inaugural professorial lectures, so they function as this dual role. And tonight our speaker is Professor Richard Porter. Now, Richard did an MA in Cambridge in the United Kingdom before doing his medical training and postgraduate training at University of Newcastle in the United Kingdom, not in Australia. He then came out and was appointed as a senior lecturer in the Department of Psychological Medicine, which is my old department, in 1999. 5 years later, he was appointed to associate professor. And in 1999, nearly 4 years ago, he was promoted to professor, and only now does he get the opportunity to give his inaugural professorial lecture. So tonight I'll hand over to Richard to talk about stress, earthquakes and the brain. Richard.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks for all coming out tonight. I must admit to feeling a little bit anxious, or I did until about now, about this lecture, because actually my last professorial inaugural lecture was scheduled for the 23rd of February 2011. And ironically was entitled Stress, Depression and the Brain. Obviously it was cancelled. Before that, I was due to give a lecture to the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners on the 4th of September 2010. So here we are, and I'm pleased to hear Peter's comments about the building code. But obviously, having researched stress and its effects on the brain for many years, the earthquake has slightly changed our research direction, because it's created a city full of people who have experienced the effects of stress on the brain. And I'll move on a little bit later in the lecture to talk about how we're trying to research some of those effects. But basically, the plan for tonight is I'm going to talk about the normal stress response, what happens in the brain and what happens in the body, what hormone response there is when people are put under stress. I'll talk about what effect that has on the brain. And then I'm going to go on to talk in quite a lot of depth about depression and think about depression as a stress-induced condition. Obviously, I'm going to go on and talk about a condition called post-traumatic stress disorder, which has been created in large numbers by the earthquake, unfortunately. I will talk about some attempts we've made to treat these conditions based on thinking of them as stress-induced conditions. And I'll talk, as I've said, about some of the research that we are doing at the moment and we'll continue to do post-earthquake. The first point I want to make is that the evolution of the brain is such that actually all of us have, some people have described it as a lizard's brain inside our brain. So the brain has evolved so that the basic functions of the brain, the innermost part of the brain, is the same in all animals. And what we've done, what humans have done in evolution, is added bits on top of that. So the stress response in a lizard is pretty similar to the stress response in a human, except that in a human we have these layers of processing on top of that. So somebody once said a lizard, when it sees something bigger than it, it gets stressed and runs away. If it sees something smaller than it, it tries to eat it. And if it sees something about the same size, it tries to mate with it. And obviously we're a little bit more complex, or some of us are, in our behaviour than that. And what you can see here is that from that basic structure, very similar shape inside the at the centre of the brain. Mammals have evolved some layers of what we call cerebral cortex on top of that, and primates, massive amounts of this processing capacity on top of that. And even more so with humans, if you look at humans compared with other primates, 90 billion neurons in the human brain, only 30 billion in the chimpanzee, which is the next most intelligent and developed species. And just to make this point a little bit further, this is evolution across time, and these are obviously our ancestors evolving to the current state today, up here, Homo sapiens. And you can see a rapid escalation in the size of the brain. Now, the point I would make is then that we're talking about some very primitive functions with all this processing grafted on top. And it would not be surprising to think that in the process of evolution, things might go wrong in the connections between the primitive and the processing part of the brain. Here, I just want you to learn a bit of brain anatomy. Okay, so I'm going to point out some important structures here. The thalamus here, I'm going to talk about in a minute, is simply a relay station that takes sensory information from the whole of the rest of the brain, which in turn takes it from the eyes, the ears, etc., relays it to areas of the brain like the amygdala, and you'll hear me talking a lot about the amygdala tonight. It's a vitally important structure, recognises fear, organises the stress response. The hippocampus, which is another very important structure, is very important in memory. And so these structures are in the middle of the brain. If this picture is as though I was standing like this and somebody chopped it right down the middle of my brain and you're looking in at one side of it. And here I'll just try to explain how the stress system works within the brain. So I've chosen an example known to you all. What if we as humans experience a potential threat, the ground begins to shake, and various senses sense that happening. Our eyes might see things moving, our feet might feel the ground moving. The thalamus organises that information and passes it on to other regions of the brain. The amygdala, which is going to organise the actual response to that, but it's modulated by the hippocampus, which has stored memories of what happened the last 10,000 times the ground shook. And it can tell us, you know, what happened each of those times. The crucial part of this, of course, for us, is the frontal cortex, the processing part of the brain. And that integrates this information, and it restrains the amygdala. And you could think of this whole system a little bit like a control centre with four men working in it. The thalamus, he just does his job, gets the information, passes it on to somebody else, and that's that. The hippocampus, he's the data analyst, the archivist. He can tell you within a very short space of time what happened the last 10 times the ground shook. The frontal cortex, he's the ideas man. He puts it all together, he thinks about it, he analyses it, and he helps in conjunction with the amygdala to decide what to do. The amygdala is the action man. If it wasn't for the frontal cortex, he would just go racing around, just acting the whole time. He's one of these action people that doesn't think a lot. The frontal cortex, he doesn't do a lot, he just sits around and thinks. So, but between the two of them, they're actually quite good together. But if that connection, if that interplay is not working, if the frontal cortex gets sidelined, then you've got a situation where the amygdala is running around responding to every potential threat and racing into action without thinking about it first. Now, that could be good, and the amygdala is a good man to have around in a real crisis, because he gets things done. And so the healthy stress response in that situation, the amygdala takes over and off you go. The ground really is shaking and so you have to act. And the first thing that happens is you get a massive release of adrenaline. And I'm sure you all know what that feels like. Your heart rate increases, you sweat, you feel a bit breathless. All things to ready you for dramatic action, for running away or for doing something quite active. What you won't be familiar with is the action of cortisol. You can't feel that. But cortisol is also the release of this stress hormone cortisol is also part of an important part of that healthy stress response. And to ready you, the animal, for a stress, it does things like make blood sugar more available to the muscles. So your blood sugar goes up so that you're readied for action. If it really is, if you mount a stress response, then the amygdala takes over, the man of action in the brain takes over, creates a sensation of fear, and it's more activated. It's more active in the brain. Whereas the frontal part of the brain, the processing part, takes a back seat. Because, you know, if you're under stress, you don't want to be sitting there thinking about things, do you? And generally speaking, the amygdala makes you much more sensitive to stimuli in the environment. You're vigilant, you're hypervigilant. And I'm sure, that, you know, to an extent, this is normal. People post-earthquakes who are vigilant to any shake of the ground, that's normal. That's a normal increased vigilance. And of course, if you're stressed in this way, you've got a lot less interest in non-essential things. You don't need to eat, you know, anytime soon. You don't need to sleep. In fact, it's not a good idea to go to sleep when something's chasing you. Now, before I talk about depression, I just want to emphasize that depression is an incredibly variable and complex condition. And I've seen people with depression who are, you know, able to go around their everyday business. They're certainly feeling low in mood, but they're not too bad. And I've seen people with depression who cannot move. They can't move, they can't speak, they can't eat. So, you know, incredibly varied condition. And so what I will say probably only applies to a percentage of people with depression. But certainly a high percentage of people show symptoms like this: reduced interest and enjoyment. Well, that's a feature of a healthy stress response, that you know, it's not a time to go and think about what you're going to do next to enjoy yourself. Sleep disturbance, we've talked about. It's, you know, sleeping heavily is not a good idea for an organism that's under some form of imminent threat. Anxiety, that's like that hypervigilance. You're constantly on edge because there is perhaps some impending threat. Appetite disturbance, no point in eating, and reduced libido, no point in procreating if you're about to be attacked by some other animal. So if you think about the symptoms of depression, they do all appear, or these ones at least, appear to be compatible with the state of a prolonged stress response. And if you look at the hormone system in depression, again, there's some evidence that would suggest that in depression, people have a prolonged activation of the hormonal stress response. So here, I'm not going to go through this in detail because it's quite a complex system, but you can see up at the top here, it's being driven by the amygdala, the man of action in the brain, and various other structures are made by the amygdala to release hormones. The hypothalamus releases these hormones. That causes the pituitary to release this hormone. And finally, at the end of this cascade, the adrenal glands produce large amounts of cortisol, which then circulate around the body. This is the stress hormone in humans. And what does cortisol do? It's in the blood. It circulates around the body. It binds to receptors. And so this is how chemicals, hormones act in the body. They go around in the blood and then they attach to little bits on the cell membranes and they cause effects like increasing blood sugar, for instance, increasing blood pressure, things that actually are quite useful if the person truly is under some imminent threat. And like any other system in the body, this system regulates itself. So the body's adapted so things don't get completely out of control. Some of the receptors in the hippocampus, the hypothalamus, glucocorticoid receptors, which I'm just called GRs here, they actually switch the system off. So cortisol levels can't go up too high because once it goes up, it switches itself off by acting on these receptors in the brain. So it's a classic negative feedback loop. But in depression, we see evidence of abnormalities at all levels of this system. We see increased levels of CRH and AVP, increased ACTH, increased levels of cortisol. And another thing that we see is that these receptors are either insensitive or there's not enough of them. It's not entirely clear which of these options it applies, and so the system doesn't switch itself off as well, and hence the potential for it to go on and on producing high levels of cortisol. Why might people be vulnerable to that happening? Well, the answer is, of course, we don't really know, but there's a few options. One is that the system has set itself wrong when people are kids. So as a child, the system's developing. It's developing its set point, the point at which it suppresses its own action. So, but a sufficient stress at that point may actually make people more vulnerable to developing depression in later life. And a factor in that might be that this system is set at the wrong level. And here's a study in people who had experienced childhood stresses, childhood trauma. And I just want you to look at panel A here, and you'll see these top two lines with the triangles here. That is people who have had early life stress and have experienced episodes of depression in their life. And these lines, these are people who have had early life stress but haven't at that point experienced depression. And this is their cortisol secretion under stress. And you can see it's much more than it is in healthy people or in people who've suffered from depression but haven't had an early life stress. So some evidence that stresses early in life reset the system at a whole different point from normal. Incidentally, I'll talk about how we stress people later, because it's interesting to see how much cortisol people produce when they're stressed. This is a classically German sort of stress test that actually has been used in psychology departments around the world, where they get volunteers with psychiatric conditions like depression, early life stress, and they make them perform mental arithmetic in front of a group of people. So it's really quite an unpleasant test, which we've never actually done, but we have our own unique stressor, which I'll show you later. The other thing to bear in mind is that possibly in certain conditions, right from the start, people have different numbers of these receptors in different parts of their brain. So people who are vulnerable to develop bipolar disorder, for instance, may have lower numbers of these receptors in parts of the hippocampus. And here you can see the bipolar disorder in yellow in a number of areas in the hippocampus have smaller numbers of these receptors compared with healthy controls. And we'll come back to that when I talk about bipolar disorder in a minute. So what about the brain in depression? What's going on in different parts of the brain? And remember, in stress, the amygdala takes over. It's more active. The frontal part of the brain is less active. In this study, it uses a technique. It was done in Pittsburgh. It uses a technique in which we put people in a scanner, a magnetic resonance image scanner, get them to do a task, and then watch what happens to parts of the brain as they do that task. So that activates different parts of the brain. In this particular part of this study, people in the scanner, so they've got their head in the tube, and then they have to do tasks while they're there. They had to rate negative words. They were read unpleasant, threat-related words like fear, attack, that sort of thing. And they had to rate, how scary that was. And as they did that, bold black line at the top here shows that people who suffered from depression, the amygdala, this deep part of the brain, the active bit of the brain in stress, activated far more than it did in the healthy controls, in the healthy subjects, this dotted line. So the amygdala is more active under this circumstance in this study. Whereas, if you get them to order digits, so you simply give them a string of digits, 1, 7, 3, 9, 6, they have to then, in their mind, put that into the correct numerical order and repeat it back. And that's that's the sort of task that's classically performed by part of the frontal cortex. Here, exactly the opposite pattern. The healthy people, a big activation of the frontal cortex here, of a particular part of it. The depressed people, much less. So in depression in this study, showing a pattern of the amygdala being more active, more reactive, the frontal cortex not so reactive in people with depression. So what does that mean for what people can do when they're depressed or under stress? And here I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the neuropsychological tests that we do in studies that we've conducted in Christchurch here. And this is a classic, it's been around since 1960. All we do in this particular task is read this list of words at a set rate, and we say to the subject who's doing the test, look, I want you to repeat back as many words as you can remember. And they do that, normally get about 6 on the first repetition. And then you say, look, I'm going to read that list of words again, and I want you to remember, again, as many as you can remember, including ones you remember the first time. And you do it 5 times. And, of course, what happens is that with each repetition, people remember more words. Until the 5th occasion, you know, most people are getting 11 to 13 or something similar like that. They've actually remembered most of those words. And then you do other tests for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, and then you say to them, ah, do you remember that list of words I read out 5 times? And if they say no, well, that's kind of the end of the test. But if they say yes, you say, okay, I want you to repeat back as many of those words as you can remember. And of course, what happens is they've forgotten some in that period of time that's filled with activity, and they're back down to 6 or 7. What we did was we got a group of healthy volunteers at the University of Canterbury. We gave them hydrocortisone, which is essentially cortisol, and we tested them after a dummy tablet and after hydrocortisone. And of course, and it's been shown before in other populations, this reduced the number of words that they could learn. So cortisol has an adverse effect on memory. It reduces your ability to remember things. So you can see quite a reasonable difference here. What happens in depression? Well, this is a study, Katie Douglas, who's in the second row here. Do you want to stand up, Katie? No, she doesn't. Did it for her PhD in Christchurch, an excellent PhD, and she recruited about 80 people with very severe depression in the inpatient unit in Hillmorton Hospital. This was one of the tasks that the patients did. Here are the healthy people, here are the people with depression. Now, if you look at that last point, the point after a 30-minute gap, there's really quite a major difference there. It's almost as much as from 10 words to 7 words. So you imagine walking around in your everyday life and you can only remember 7 things that you've learned 30 minutes earlier compared with you can remember 10 things. It's quite a major significant difference. And, of course, people with depression complain bitterly often of difficulty with short-term and longer-term memory, for that matter. And why is that? Well, it may be parts of the brain acting differently. It might be a direct effect of the cortisol, which, of course, we've seen does have this effect on verbal learning. Here's another task we frequently do in studies, spatial working memory task. And on this occasion, this is a touch-sensitive computer screen. What people have to do is search through the red boxes until they find a blue counter. So they simply touch the red boxes on the screen, they open up, and there may or may not be a blue counter in there. They can then put them in the little bin to the side of the screen by just pressing that. And the task is, of course, to find 6 counters in this situation. So here we've found a counter in that bottom box. The important thing to remember is you must not search the same box twice. The computer will never hide the counter in the same box twice. So if on a subsequent attempt to find further counters, we come back and touch this bottom box, then we've committed a between search error, and that'll be recorded. So continue searching, avoiding boxes where a token has been found. And again, and this is much milder depression. This is a study I did in Newcastle, in general practices in Newcastle, where people were seeking treatment from their GPs, and we did a series of neuropsychological tests and compared that with healthy people matched for age, etc. And you can see here at the 6-box problem, which I've illustrated down here, the depressed people made many more between search errors, that returning to that box where they could not remember they'd already found a token. And on the eight-box problem, which you can imagine would get really quite taxing, they did even worse. And that task, studies have suggested, is very much mediated by the same area of the prefrontal cortex that is important in restraining the amygdala and is important in that digit sorting task that I showed you people doing in a scanner. So it's an important part of the brain. Now, we've talked a lot about the hippocampus, about memory. What is cortisol actually doing to the hippocampus, to this crucial bit of the brain that, remember, in that initial diagram, it's the archive bit of the brain. It remembers things. It uses that to help the brain judge stress responses. Well, if you take animals and you either give them cortisol or you stress them, this part of the brain actually shrink. The numbers of cells reduce. The branching reduces. If you give them any antidepressant that's known in humans to treat depression effectively, it reverses it. It makes it grow again. If you scan people who've had repeated episodes of depression, in fact, the hippocampus tends to be smaller. So there's some evidence that it's actually shrunk over the years and over a series of episodes of depression. And again, in post-traumatic stress disorder, there is some evidence that the hippocampus is small. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the hippocampus and things now, but what you've probably been sitting there thinking, this is all very well, but humans are a bit more sophisticated than this. You know, more to us than remembering which box the counter is in. And of course there is, you know, all that prefrontal cortical area, the front of the brain, is involved in lots of processing, including emotional processing. And this is something else we've studied in stress and in depression, looking at what effect this has on people's abilities to recognize emotions. Now, there are six basic emotions which have been researched in ethological research over the years, and they're recognized by all cultures, and they probably have an evolutionary significance and, you know, to some extent, exist in less sophisticated primates. I haven't put a surprise here because it's not an emotion we've used in our tasks, but the emotions are disgust, fear, happiness, sadness, anger, and surprise. So have you all done that? Your emotional processing is intact? I might not get this right myself, but Katie will tell me if I'm wrong. So here we have happy. That's sad, isn't it? Yeah. Angry. Fearful and disgusted. And what we can do with a computer is morph these faces so that actually here this man is only 50% sad. So the computer's morphed his expression from neutral to extremely angry. Here he's 100%, oh, he's not sad, he's angry. Oh, sorry, I got that wrong. 50% angry. And then at the other end, he's 100% angry. And this is the basis of a task that we did in subjects with depression. They basically get a series of these faces of different emotions popping up on the screen. They have six buttons. They have to press the button that on it has a label saying disgust or happy or sad or neutral. And this is another task that we did in the 80 inpatients with severe depression. And what that showed was that in terms of accuracy of recognizing facial emotions, the people with severe depression had a very specific deficit in recognizing disgust. There was no significant difference in other emotions, but disgust was very specifically depressed. We have a number of theories why that might be, but the one I'm going to talk about today is that disgust is in many ways a uniquely social expression. It's how we express to other people, you know, that we're disgusted at what the food tastes like. My children show expressions of disgust every time I cook them vegetables. And, you know, it's a social, eating, interacting type of expression. Not something that you need when you're under an acute stress. And so perhaps this part of processing has been abandoned in favor of something that's more useful in the stressed condition. You can't explain everything by reference to the stress system, and I'm not going to attempt to with this next finding, but it is interesting. that when we, amongst these expressions that we showed people with depression, were neutral facial expressions. And sometimes people said they were neutral, but sometimes they misclassified them. They said the neutral expression was anger or whatever. And so we analysed the misclassifications. What we found was that depressed people, people with severe depression, were much more likely than the healthy controls to misclassify them as sad, and the healthy controls were more likely to misclassify neutral expressions as happy. So there's a negative bias. People with depression are interpreting these neutral expressions much more as a negative emotion. Now, again, another bit of sophistication here. Of course, we all are able to tell, to some extent, what is a genuine and what is a non-genuine facial expression of emotion. We watch our politicians all the time give non-genuine smiles. And of course, we're not the first person to realize this. This is Charles Darwin back in 1872, a book that he wrote. And here, in panel A, in a slightly unsophisticated way, he's produced a smile by putting some fairly crude electrodes on this chap's muscles, facial muscles, and stimulating them. You know, I mean, you could, if you'd had too much to drink, you could think this was a smile, but it's not particularly convincing, is it? Whereas on the right-hand side, on panel B, he'd actually been told a joke. I don't know what sort of jokes Charles Darwin told, but... and here is what, with a few $1,000 of orthodontic work, could be quite an engaging and genuine smile. And colleagues at the University of Canterbury, Tracy McClellan and Lucy Johnson, have examined this phenomenon, and what they've produced is, with a huge amount of work, is a set of pictures of genuine and posed expressions. So now, down on this column here is neutral expressions. This is happy, this is sad, this is fearful. And I'm sure you can all tell which column is genuine and which is posed. Posed, genuine, just in case anybody couldn't tell that. And again, we tested this in people with depression. We showed them expressions, some of which were posed, some of which were genuine, different emotions, and we asked them to judge, is this person really showing the emotion? Are they feeling the emotion, which is genuine, or are they showing the emotion? And, you know, people with depression were perfectly adequately able to differentiate between the two, but they were slightly less able to differentiate between genuine and posed sadness. So if you think of that in the context of the previous results, the misinterpretation of neutral expressions, again, it's a negative bias. It's a bias towards interpreting other people's facial expressions as being of sadness or negativeness. And that may have a very important effect in social interactions with that bias, may have an important effect in perpetuating people's low mood and how they're feeling in social interactions. Okay, so you might be thinking, well, look, we've got all this data which tells us a little bit about the stress system in depression, the hormone system in depression. Why don't you do something about it? And, of course, the answer is we've tried. And, in fact, many researchers have tried around the world, and they've produced drugs that block this hormone so it doesn't cause a release of hormone. Quite widely used has been a drug that blocks the production of cortisol. But we wanted to approach this from a slightly different angle. And in a system, the receptors in a system, if you block them completely and there's no effect, then the organism, the physiology is that the organism tries to compensate for that. So if we can block these glucocorticoid receptors really strongly so that cortisol can't get to them, it can't do anything, then the likelihood is that the brain is going to increase the numbers of them in an attempt to compensate for that very unphysiological block that we've induced. And we know other drugs, if you block receptors in the brain, the numbers increase. So what we decided to do is give a drug that very powerfully blocks these receptors And the hope would be that the numbers would increase, we'd be able to withdraw the drug, and we'd have a system that's back to normal, because these receptors would then, there would be enough of them to reset the whole system to a level at which it terminates its own secretion, the cortisol stops its own secretion adequately, and the system can't get out of control. And after some preliminary work in Newcastle, researchers, colleagues in Newcastle and myself here in Christchurch did a study in which we treated people with bipolar depression, people who suffer from both highs and lows, essentially. And the depression in bipolar depression is often quite resistant to treatment. So we treated people either with, again, a placebo treatment, a sugar tablet for 7 days, or with this blocking agent mifepristone for 7 days. And then we followed them up and we did various tests in the weeks subsequent to that. Rather unfortunately, the treatment which we'd hoped would be a breakthrough in the treatment of bipolar depression had absolutely no effect on mood. So this is a mood rating scale, and they start off quite seriously depressed. As is common in any study in depression, the very act of doing something active, trying to help them, brings the scores down. But you can see between placebo and this drug, absolutely no difference. But what was a little bit more encouraging was that when we repeated this spatial working memory task, the one I talked about before with regard to depression, when we repeated that 8 weeks after the treatment, the group that had had the active treatment made very significantly fewer errors than the group that had had placebo. So somehow we had, in a long-term way, reset the system so that actually their performance on this task was improved, but for some reason we hadn't managed to improve mood. So it was a start, it was better than nothing, and it's an interesting finding given what we've seen about what happens to this test in depression and the effect that cortisol can have in depressing performance on this test. Which brings me to talk about the earthquake. Had I given the lecture 2 years ago, a lot of what I've said would have still been in it, apart from some data that came in. But obviously, on the 22nd of September, of February, for somebody who's interested in stress responses and mental health problems, things changed quite dramatically in Christchurch. And one of the things that happened following the earthquake is that the Canterbury District Health Board set up a service specifically to try to help people with post-earthquake mental health disorders. And that's headed by Caroline Bell, who's not here tonight, but who I've been working with following the earthquake, looking at what we can do in terms of researching the effects of this very dramatic stress upon people's brains. What sort of conditions have people developed post-earthquake? Well, post-traumatic stress disorder, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail in a minute, is clearly a key condition that people have developed. And the service that Caroline heads looks after people predominantly with post-traumatic stress disorder and runs group treatments for this. But not surprisingly, depression is very common in the face of this acute and then chronic stress afterwards. Anxiety, other anxiety problems, and of course substance abuse, which in many cases is an attempt to dampen down some of the symptoms of other psychiatric problems, other anxiety problems. Post-traumatic stress disorder, the features of it are that the sufferer relives in some way the stress that's brought it on. That might be intrusive, frequent, repetitive, distressing memories, repeatedly thinking about what happened. In some cases, it's quite vivid visual memories, visual flashbacks. People suddenly get into the vision of what happened to them coming into their mind. Sometimes it's nightmares, and quite often it's all three of those. And things trigger those flashbacks and distressing memories. So, for instance, going back near the central city for many people is a real trigger. Going into any high building, those sort of things, any reference or footage on TV might even trigger that. So a lot of people won't watch the TV because of that. And that'll trigger these memories. And consequently, people avoid these things and get very, very anxious at any suggestion that they're going to have to do these things. And thirdly, people are incredibly vigilant. So any little shake, you know, a bus goes past, they'll jump. They're monitoring the environment for any suggestion of a further threat. So, you know, in many ways, it's almost like a chronic stress, heightened stress response. Very close links to depression. Many, many people who suffer from PTSD also suffer from depression. You know, they're incredibly closely linked conditions. The surprising about post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, it's a disorder following an acute stressor, and you'd think that we would have worked out by now exactly what's going on in parts of the brain and in the stress hormone system. The diagram I showed you of the cortisol system, and we've studied that in depression for many years, it's been worked out to some extent what is going on in depression. But in PTSD, it's surprising how little we know about what goes on in that system. And some studies have shown that it's overactive. Some studies have shown that it's underactive. One theory suggests that people who are likely to get PTSD, perhaps in that acute stress, they didn't mount a big enough cortisol response. Remember, cortisol impairs the formation of memory. So maybe it's functional to have masses of cortisol circulating and swilling around the brain, and that stops these memories from becoming over-encoded in the hippocampus and then repeating themselves afterwards. But we don't really know. And one of the reasons we don't know is that it's actually not as simple a condition as you might think. Sometimes it's associated with depression. Sometimes it's associated with childhood trauma. Sometimes it's associated with ongoing stresses. So people that suffer from PTSD, often the stress they suffered that caused the condition has also left them with lots of other ongoing stresses, just as many people in the earthquake are left with housing problems and job losses and all those sort of things. That does give us an advantage in Christchurch in terms of researching this, because what we can do is we can study people with post-traumatic stress disorder who got that as a consequence of something that happened in the earthquake, you know, being in the central city with buildings falling, etc. But we also have access to lots of people who had very, very similar experiences but didn't get post-traumatic stress disorder. And not only did they have similar experiences during the earthquake, but they had similar stresses ongoing after the earthquake. So it's a good group to compare and to try to work out what's different about the people that went on and got post-traumatic stress disorder. And to do that, we have two studies that are currently underway. And the first one looks at the same sort of things with some modifications that we've looked at in depression, that we looked at in inpatients with depression, we've looked at in several different groups. And what we want to do is take people who've developed post-traumatic stress disorder, measures of emotional processing, similar to what I've shown you here, and also measure cortisol in response to stress and at baseline. And what we want to do is then compare that with people who've had similar levels of stress and experience in the earthquake and see perhaps if we can tease out why one group got PTSD and the other group didn't. And that may lead us to have some ideas about treatment as well. And in fact, some years ago, a study was published in which people with PTSD were given cortisol, hydrocortisone, every day for 3 months. The idea being that somehow that would dampen down the memories coming from the hippocampus. And there was some positive response in those people. So that's the things we want to study. How are we going to study stress? You know, we're not going to take lots of people with PTSD and stress them. Well, in fact, we are. We're going to expose them on a daily basis to one of the most stressful things that people can be exposed to, and that is waking up. And it won't surprise anybody in this room to find out that when you wake, your cortisol levels go up dramatically. It's an incredibly stressful experience, waking up. And here's a previous study that's examined that. This is healthy people. You can see the cortisol from baseline, the minute they wake, goes up. Peaks at about 30 minutes. And then, you know, once you've had your second cup of coffee and sort of resigned to going to work, it begins to come down again. And interestingly, on this slide, patients who've had depression and have recovered from it have a higher level of waking salivary cortisol. And what we want to do in our patients who've suffered from PTSD is measure this response, compare it with people who haven't developed PTSD, and see if there's a systematic difference between the two. Again, what's going on in the brains of people with PTSD? You would think that was perhaps by now well worked out as well. But it's not, but there is some evidence that similar changes occur to those that we've seen in depression, that the amygdala is more active and parts of the frontal cortex are less active. And what was done in this study is that in the scanner, people were exposed to their own accounts of what had happened to them to cause the PTSD. And of course, the brain then whirs into action to process that. And in this particular study, when that happened, when people were exposed to their own accounts of what had happened to them, the frontal parts of the brain here and here were less active than in healthy people. And so, again, this is a system that we want to use. We get people to generate their own scripts with their therapists of traumatic events. They then read them on some goggles in the scanner, and we see what happens to their brain activation during that process. We also get a group of people who have experienced events in the earthquake but haven't developed PTSD to do the same process. And one other thing we get them to do is to do this twice. And on one occasion, they take a sugar tablet before the scan. On the other occasion, they take a dose of hydrocortisone, so cortisol, to see how this modifies the brain response to these memories. Again, trying to understand what is the role of cortisol in PTSD, what does it do to brain activation, and is this something we should follow further as a possible treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder? So I just want to sum up now what I've said today. A number of things determine how people mount a stress response and what form that stress response takes. And those things are obviously the severity of the stress. And there are some stressors that are so severe that this system is going to be active for a long period of time, and there's nothing you can really do about that. But that is modified by past experience, particularly in childhood, and probably by genetics. People are set at different levels in terms of their stress response. It is, of course, normal to have a stress response to genuine stresses, but if that is an abnormal response or if it goes on for too long, way beyond the acute threat of the stressor, then people do end up developing mental health problems, particularly depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'm going to finish there by acknowledging some collaborators, Peter, Caroline Bell, who runs the earthquake team, Katie, who's in the second row. Do you want to stand up now? No? Some other researchers at the University of Otago, Canterbury. I'd like to acknowledge Wendy, who makes my slides, keeps me relatively organised.